Welcome to Sentient Developments Radio. My name is George Dvorsky, and you are listening to the audio cast of my blog, Sentient Developments, Transhumanist Perspectives on Science, Philosophy, Ethics, and the Future of Intelligent Life. Topics discussed on Sentient Developments Radio include transhumanism,
bioethics,
human enhancement,
the singularity,
accelerating change,
technology,
neuroscience,
cosmology,
catastrophic risk,
existentialism,
spirituality,
philosophy,
science. So sit back, relax, and open your mind to Sentient Developments Radio. Welcome to Sentient Developments Radio. My name is George Dvorsky, podcasting to you today on Friday, May the 12th, 2006. Today's broadcast will be exclusively devoted to a rebroadcast of Mark Walker's presentation for the Toronto Transhumanist Association that happened back on April the 20th of this year. Dr. Walker spoke at the University of Toronto's Bauhin Center for Information Technology, and he delivered a presentation about the ethics of radical life extension, or as Walker refers to it, as super longevity. We organized, when I say we, I mean the Toronto Transhumanist Association organized the talk, and it was partly adapted from Dr. Walker's recent paper titled Universal Super Longevity, Is It Inevitable and Is It Good? Mark Walker is a research associate in philosophy at Trinity College at the U of T. He's the founder and president of Permanent and International, a nonprofit organization devoted to ending hunger, illiteracy, and environmental degradation. He serves on the editorial board for the Journal of Evolution and Technology, and he's served on the board of directors of the World Transhumanist Association, and he currently serves on the board for the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. At the event, we had pretty good attendance. About 20 people were there, and Walker spoke for about an hour, and he discussed the ethical issues about life extension. He focused on two major objections or concerns to super longevity, particularly the potential boredom issue, which is often brought up, the boredom of radically extended lives, and the issue of overpopulation. Again, another popular issue that's usually put forth as a major counter-argument against radical life extension. But while these things are a potential problem, they're not untenable ones, and Mark addresses these directly. He offers a number of solutions, and I'm not going to give away any spoilers. I'm sure you'll enjoy the podcast of the discussion. And yeah, that's about it for now, and hopefully I'll have some, other Sentient Developments related items to podcast about in the near future, although I am quite busy these days preparing for Stanford, which is now about 2 weeks away, and crunch time, so I better get really working on refining my presentation, which is going to be on the ethics of animal uplift. So here is the rebroadcast of Mark Walker's presentation for the TTA, and again, this was recorded on April the 20th, 2006.
Let me give you a little bit of background. I teach a course at McMaster that covers a lot of transhumanist themes, and by the end of the semester, the final exam I've given the students has an essay component, and they're asked to write whether they think, you know, in the next 20, 50, or 100 years, if we had the technology, should we use technology to make people smarter if we can, so to say biologically alter our brains to make ourselves smarter. That's one part of the question. Another part asks whether we should use technology to try to make ourselves more moral. And in the course I cover the idea of using genetics to make ourselves be more virtuous. So part of the argument is that there are genes that would help us to be more truthful and caring for others and so on. Another part asks them whether we should use technology to make ourselves happier. So you can use happy pills, or indeed some people think there are a genetic basis for how happy some people are. Some people seem fairly happy, you know, sort of impervious to their surroundings, and so on. The thought might be there might be a genetic basis for it. And finally, whether we should use technology to extend human lifespan. The record now is 122 years. That's the longest any human has lived in recorded history. biblical stories aside. So the thought would be, well, if we can use technology, and given that we are ultimately based in some sort of material world, if we can replace the little Lego blocks that make us up, keep ourselves going, should we extend our lives another 50 or 100 years, or maybe more? That's the thought. And I was quite surprised, though, what the students wrote in response to this essay question. Most of them were on board with the idea of using technology to make people more virtuous, which was, I mean, kind of surprising. It's a thought that hasn't been explored a lot. The poor suckers had to read a couple papers by myself on the topic. But it's sort of a newer idea that's out there. But a lot of them were on board with that. Second on their list of, I mean, some were against all of it, right? But this is, some were against using technology at all to do anything with our biology. But first on their list would be genetic enhancements for virtue. So a lot of them would go for that. I'd say maybe 80% of the class did. 20% were against any sort of thing. Next on their list was enhancing intelligence. So there was maybe a drop off of about 20%. So a lot of them would want to do something for virtue, not so many for intelligence. And then really dropping off near the bottom there was the idea of enhancing our level of subjective well-being, trying to make ourselves happier using biological or pharmacological agents. And the very bottom of the list was the idea of extending our lifespans. That's the thing that they found the least desirous of those four different things, which kind of blew me away. At least the first time I saw them write on all this. I mean, there's all these reality shows. Our whole culture is imbibed with this sort of youthful thing, trying to look youthful. And what better way to look youthful than to be youthful, I would have thought. And the thought is that when you're thinking about extending human lifespan, it's the same old thing, right? Same old damn humans, only living longer. So in some ways, it seems, you know, not nearly as frightening as, the prospect of what I've described as creating a homo bigheadus. There's genes that control the size of how big people's brains grow. You can tweak a few of these and you could create a being with a brain twice the size. How smart would that be? Would it leave us in the dust like we leave Homo erectus in the dust? We don't know, but we actually have the technology today. We could go do that after my lecture. We could go do that in a lab if we could break in. There's no technological reason why we couldn't do that today. We have no idea what would happen, but the technology is already there. It's just a matter of tweaking some genes. We even know where they are. That's, a big kind of frightening thought. The students were more bored with that, though, than they were with the idea of extending human lifespan, which is really kind of blows me away again, because it's just living longer doesn't seem to be sort of challenge our conception of what we are in the same way of changing our virtues or our intelligence would. So you wonder why the students aren't on board with this. And I'm not really sure myself. They had to write things in their essays that try and defend their view, but clearly what they write in there didn't seem to be indicative of how strong their reaction was to it. So I'm not entirely sure, but the two most common objections you hear to super longevity are boredom and overpopulation. So I want to talk a bit about those this evening. So let's make sure we all got our mind around the sort of thought here. So we're imagining that, say, sometime in the next 20 years or even 100 years, if it's 100 years, boo-hoo for us here tonight, probably won't be around, but still, it's worth thinking about the ethical consequences of this. If you don't think that's the case, then why are you worried about the environment, right? You can pollute the environment all you want for the next few years. It's the problem down the road that we're thinking about with the environment. Well, same thing with super longevity. You should be thinking about the problem down the road there. So the one kind of common objection goes like this, is that if you live a lot longer, you will quickly run out of things to do and be bored. And so what's all the fuss about super longevity? And that's indeed what a lot of the students mentioned. I find that, I mean, well, I should say, and one thing is I don't know whether that's true or not, but it does seem a kind of funny objection, which is, if we have the technology and everybody's going to be bored, why would anybody be interested in it at all, right? So there won't be any kind of ethical concern, so why are you worried about stopping its production or manufacture or distribution? If you think everybody's going to be bored, there would be no interest in it. It's not going to be a huge run on this technology if everybody's going to be bored and not enjoy their lives. So that's sort of one sort of thought. I'm not sure, but maybe their thought was a bit more complicated. Maybe it was something like this, that suppose we have this technology there and people start using, extending their lives. Maybe they'll end up being bored, but they'll be too frightened or unable to commit suicide or to stop using the technology. So we'll kind of back ourselves into this corner where all of us are sitting around living long, long lives, being super bored. I guess maybe that's the thought. And so then what would we do? We would step in as a society and outlaw this thing for people's own good, I guess. But that does sound awfully paternalistic, doesn't it? Saying we will stop you living longer for your own good. That is indeed a frightening form of paternalism, and indeed it's not one way we would sort of authorize right now. Imagine going around to nursing homes, as they used to be called, and saying, for your own good, we're going to cut you off your medication or whatever, because look, you're bored here. Look, you think lawn bowling's fun? Come on, that's no way to live. That would be a terrible kind of thing to do. On the other hand, some people who are transhumanists or other who are more open to this kind of idea, I think go too far the other way, which say, oh, there's so many things to do in this universe, we'll never be bored. I don't know about that. I mean, I leave it open as an empirical question, one that we need to sort of run the experiment, get the technology, and see what happens. Hey, Steve. Part of what I want to say is that pro-longevity involves, ethical concerns, but ethical concerns also have an empirical kind of dimension to them. Let me give you a couple examples. 100 bit more years ago, women started fighting for the vote in Western democracies. Now, to us, that seems so obvious, right? Of course, they should have the vote and so on. But, I have to be very careful here, but go back in time to when this was all going on. People were debating this in the 19th century, whether women should have the vote or not. A lot of women didn't have the educational opportunities that men did, the formal educational opportunities, going to school and so on. And indeed, they wouldn't have had the sort of less formal educational opportunities, right? Why would you discuss politics with women, right? I mean, that would be absurd. Well, that was, it's absurd to say that now, but back then that was the kind of thinking. So women didn't have the same kind of educational opportunities to participate in political discussion or political life and so on. And so a lot of the argument was then is that women aren't sort of capable of political thought, participation and so on. And if you just looked around at the different kinds of people there, yeah, surely the men were better able to participate in politics. They've got much more background in it and so on. But the people at the time there thought, it had something to do with women's nature and so on. So the experiment was run. We ran the experiment and gave women the vote and so on, gave them more educational opportunities, and it turned out to be a glorious result, in my opinion. It was a very good thing, and the experiment proved just as some people said it would, as people like John Stuart Mill, who fought for women's rights. He said that, he makes a very similar point, is women may not be as politically savvy as men are. Why? Because you don't give them any opportunity. Give them the opportunity, they will grow and flourish and be the same kinds of political beings that men are. So the experiment was run. Now, it's at least logically possible. I'm not saying there's any real chance of it, but we could imagine a world where there was big biological differences in men and women's brains and so on, so that women aren't as rational as men. I'm not saying, please don't get me, I hope this doesn't cut out right here, this part of the recording this. That is at least a logical possibility. It's nothing to do with the kind of world we live in, but we could imagine one where there's two different genders. We'll say, make it men that don't have the same smarts as women in another sort of imaginary world. It might be that one is not capable of political participation. So I'm just trying to give you the idea of that in some sense it was an experiment. We didn't know the outcome in advance. But it was a great experiment, and it had the right kind of outcome, in my view. But here's another experiment that didn't go quite so well. If you remember in the 60s and the 70s, there was a similar kind of liberation movement for children. One manifestation was the Summer Hill program, right? So you get kids don't need to be, you know, tyrannized by formal education and so on. If you just put them there, you know, put them around some books and so on, they will flourish and learn things all on their own. They don't need, you know, people shoving all this stuff in their brains and so on. And when you think about how sort of strict and indeed how mean-spirited schools might have been back then, there's something to this. But by and large, the experiment was a failure. That it didn't. You just can't put kids in a library and expect them to flourish. And so on. Some do. I mean, without, you know, parental guidance or teaching and so on. But a lot of them need a lot of guidance along the way and some formal structure and so on like that. And so this idea that you could just throw every kid in there and let every kid just sort of go off and flourish and so on, that failed quite dramatically. That kids raised in that way just didn't do as well as those raised in more formal setting. Again, I mean, there's a whole continuum here in the kinds of things that happened back in the 60s with strapping and so on. I'm not condoning that. But I'm saying that that experiment failed and so on. At the time, though, I mean it was... was again an experimental kind of thing. Put the kids in there, see what happens, and it failed. So why don't we have a good experiment and a bad experiment? I'm suggesting the same thing would happen with super longevity. We could run the experiment, and we'll see. It may be that people just get bored after a while. Maybe it's not 122 years. Maybe 150 years is enough. Maybe very nature of minds are that they kind of get exhausted with living. Maybe there's sort of like a decay rate with minds. A half-life of how long anybody could be interested. I think it's possible. I don't think it's particularly likely, but I think we should leave it open as at least an experimental possibility. And so if you find yourself arguing about these issues, don't back yourself into the corner where you say, I know for certain that things will always be interesting for people. I don't think so. And in fact, I think there'll probably be like a normal curve for that, you know, that some people are bored at 30. They've done everything they want to and kind of just, you know, they've climbed all the mountains by the time they're 30 and then they hang around bored and so on. Others, you know, it will, you know, maybe the curve will go off. But some people, I think, will be happy to live hundreds and hundreds of years working on a single project. I have little doubt that if Einstein were still alive today, he would still be pulling at his funny hair trying to find a grand unified theory of everything. That would be a project that would engage him, that Picasso would still be painting and so on. And I mean, it doesn't have to be such grand examples. There would be, I think, people who would be perfectly happy to be a great, great, great grandparent, and every time a new generation comes along, they might be excited to see a new set of children running around underfoot and so on. So all that seems to be possible. And again, it's still... I still think there might be this sort of curve. Some people will be bored and not want to keep accessing this technology and so on. That's fine. We let them work it out for themselves. So that's what I say to the boredom objection. Run the experiment. We'll see what happens. Overpopulation is the other real biggie. Indeed, in my students' papers, that was the one that figured very prominently. See, they weren't going to engage in this technology because they're doing good for humanity. They will cease to exist so that the world doesn't become overpopulated. And so that was, you know, very generous of them, I thought. I think I think someone had that view. I don't know if you remember this episode from the old Star Trek where Kirk goes down this planet and they've tricked him into going down there because he's a carrier of some disease that if he lets this disease get out into this overpopulated world, it will help reduce their population. This world is one, I guess, we're kind of imagining where you have all this lovely technology that keeps you alive forever and ever, and so nobody dies. And so, but I always remember this image from on the Star Trek there, where the world is so crowded that they're all walking around like this, right next to each other, and it's just the whole world is full like that. And so, I guess that would be a world that would be overpopulated when every square inch of it is filled up with people, but. It is actually hard to figure out what counts as overpopulation. And before we were to give up on the, say, well, we should not allow super longevity because it will lead to overpopulation. Well, first of all, we should figure out what overpopulation is. And that's actually not as easy as a problem as you would think. Part of the problem is it has a ineliminable kind of normative element to it, meaning that it's not something where you can just look as a matter of science and say there's X number of people per square inch, or like in the Star Trek one, or per square mile or whatever. That we need some sort of, we need that kind of information. We need to know how many people there are and how big the place is. But we'd also need to know what sort of the ideal would be and then how far we stray from that. So let me give you a little example to sort of get your mind around it. How many people should you have at a house party before it's overpopulated? Well, you can throw the kind of parties I have, and be three people there looking at each other, and it's getting late, it's almost 10, so off they go. That's not an overpopulated, it's not an overpopulated party. Mine are not overpopulated parties. But I remember as a young man going to parties that were overpopulated when you couldn't even get on the lawn of the house, where the house was for the party. It was really like the Star Trek world where everybody is. That's overpopulated. So there's hundreds and hundreds of people trying to cram into a small little house and so on. But how many makes the ideal party is the question. We'll obviously want to know how big the house is and so on, but is it like when there's not enough snacks for everybody, or when there's a long lineup for the washroom, or these sorts of things. All these would be kinds of not merely sort of scientific questions. The scientific question would be how many square feet is the house, how many people are in it, and so on. But there is this normative element. What would make for the ideal kind of party? And the same thing with when we think about the level of population for our Earth. Right, the UN has a great little study that's available online, and they've got a whole bunch of experts together and projected the world's population to the year 2300. Talk about sticking your neck out. And they've done it very methodically. Like they go from region to region and figure out how many people are likely to be. And so it basically goes up from here. We're a little past 6. Billion, well, quite a bit past 6 billion, but it's supposed to around 2050 get up to a bit more than 9 billion, and it's supposed to sort of dip down again slightly and then go back. But more or less, for the kind of precision we're thinking about tonight, is it's going to go up to about 9 billion by the year 2050 and sort of level off to the end of their projection period, 2300. they don't say, but I'm assuming that it's not so overpopulated. There's nothing in their study that says that they think we should start shooting anybody or so on. So I don't know how overpopulated it is. So, but to give you some idea what the Earth could actually sustain, how many people could actually sustain, we are basically 100-watt machines. It takes about 100 watts to keep us running. If you could do pure energy conversion, and maybe in the future we could do that. You could take about a square meter, you can get 1,000 watts in direct sunlight and so on, so you have a little battery to keep the electricity going. And I think I worked it out today, it would be something like 5 to the 14th power people on the earth. We have like, you know, say 7 to the 9th. So we could have about magnitude of what is that? We're about 10 billion more times many more people as we do today. If you did the Star Trek kind of world where you had everybody squeezed in together with one meter by 1 meter, you'd have to cover the oceans too. So we'd have to make something for the people to stand on, little floaty shoes or something like that. But we could have that many people, and there's enough energy to actually sustain that many humans. It would be an awful kind of existence, but that's possible. But again, we get to that problem: how many people should we have? What would make an ideal kind of situation? Philosophers actually thought about this a bit, and one sort of famous answer is: you should keep adding people until you no longer get to the point where you're making the world a happier place. This is a view that goes back to John Stuart Mill's, who I mentioned earlier. So the idea is maximize happiness. So when you're sitting there figuring out how you want your world to be ideally, add another person. If that adds to the total happiness of the world, then keep going until you get to the point where that last person in there starts to detract from the total happiness. Then you snatch that person back, I guess.
Most recently, there was a philosopher pointed out this kind of problem with this sort of thought experiment, which is this: is that imagine again, our party or something like that. You have 100 people there who, excuse me, are on a 0 to 10 scale of how good the party is. Suppose their average response is 9, so it's a pretty darn good party, right? 9 average response. So 9 times 100 is 900. That 900 units of party happiness, right? Okay. Now imagine we have 901 people jammed into the party, each of them having a pretty darn miserable time. Their average happiness there is 1. Okay, so we have 901 units of party happiness. They're really not having that great of a time, right? It's just barely registering. But we still have more total happiness, right? With 900 people jammed in there having just a bit better than a miserable time, is a better party than having 100 people there having one of the best parties ever. This is what this philosopher calls the repugnant conclusion. But now apply that to the world here too. Is it better to have billions and billions and billions of extra people, but all of them not having a particularly happy time, but when we add it all together, it makes things happier? Or is it better to have fewer people who have an average, higher average amount of happiness? It's it's hard to... either way you're damned. Philosophers have worked on this. On the one hand, if we do this, we get to this point where our Earth would be so crowded because we keep adding people even though there's only a teeny little bit of happiness because it adds to the total amount. Or if you go with this, the other thought would be, let's just go with the point where the average happiness is highest. Okay? Well, so what would happen there? Well, suppose we were thinking about putting you into existence, but you're not quite as happy as the average person. Well, then we shouldn't add you into the lot then, so our population will be a bit smaller, and so on. And indeed, it will keep getting smaller and smaller until we have just a few very, very happy people left, right? Because you don't want to add anybody else on there who's not as happy as these super happy people. Why? Because they will bring down the average. So either we have this really small but very happy population, but not allowing any new people in, which would be a lot smaller than our world population is probably right now. Or we get this other world, sort of like the Star Trek one, where we're all kind of jammed in there. So it's a very difficult question to figure out exactly what would be an ideal population. And so that's one thing we'd have to think about with overpopulation. Now there's another sort of point I want to think about too is Max Moore is a transhumanist who's written on overpopulation recently, and one of the things he pointed out in his paper was that you know, what really matters to total population is how many children you have, not how long you live. Is by and large, population is more a function of how many children people are having rather than how long you you live. I mean, you sort of do the math. The UN's predicting we'll more or less be at replacement levels by the year 2050. So if everybody's, means that everybody would be having one child on average to keep the population steady. But imagine everybody had two children, right? Then it would keep doubling. If we have a 70-year generation time, then instead of being 9 billion by the year 2120, it would be 18 billion. And then 70 years later, it would be 36 billion and so on. That's just by having, instead of you having just one child and then dying, it would be having two children and dying. So only one more, and at least this huge increase is Max Moore's thought. And he also points out, too, that the more developed countries are, the lower the birth rate tends to be. Right? The most advanced technological countries are the ones that have the lowest birth rates. That applies to everywhere except for the one slight aberration there is the United States of America. They're not quite in sync with the rest of the, you know, the European countries and Canada. Their birth rate's still a bit higher, but more or less this is this general trend. And so Max Moore argues, well, look, you know, the more we develop technologically, the lower the birth rate's going to go. And so if we allow people to live a long time with super longevity, there won't be a population problem because it's tending to go down. I don't find this very compelling myself. I mean, for one reason, this may be news to some people on the street who don't know anything about population and the birth rates going down in developed countries. But it's certainly not news to people who think seriously about population issues. It's not like the people doing the UN study went, you know, when they found out. This is all factored into their study. I mean, it's indeed, when they look at individual countries, they figure out how technologically advanced they're going to be in the next 50 years, and they part chart their birth rate in connection with that. So it, you know, I don't think that point's going to be particularly compelling for those who are worried about population who think about it seriously. Also, I think also there's a real kind of tension, though, in this idea. One of the selling points of super longevity is supposed to be this, is that if you live longer, you're going to have more opportunity to do different things. Longer life, you can you know, experience more, you can do more, you can achieve more. But it seems to me one of the things that you might do or achieve is have children. And so if you're around for a long time, it seems to me almost inevitable that the birth rate will climb back up for especially amongst super longevitous. And so if you think about that, then it does lead to a population kind of problem as much as my students suggested. Let me give you some reasons to think that's the case. There's some statistics there, but I won't get them out. But here's roughly the idea. If you look at birth rates right now are slightly below replacement levels here in Canada. It's like 1.9 children per couple or something. So, you know, missing a tenth of a child. So this is people missing a shoulder or something. But so it's not quite at to replacement rate, but we still import people, just to use the commodity kind of talk. So, you know, Canada's population is still growing. But remember, that's an average. And if you look at 10 couples, I think the statistics say something like 10 couples, two of them won't have any children at all. And then maybe, I think it's like maybe another four couples will each have one, maybe three to four couples will have one child each. And then the last few couples have quite a few children, like three or more children. So One thought I imagine is, imagine we actually achieve super longevity, and part of that means not just living longer, but longer, healthier lives, which means, as a consequence, unless we do something about it, people will be able to have children a lot longer. If you have a body that's sort of biologically equivalent to our average 25-year-old now, and you're 150, then you will have the prospect. You can be like Tony Randall and have kids when you're 150 years old, right? There's no biological reason why you can't have kids when you're 150 years old. Now you think about those 10 couples I was mentioning. Maybe some of them will never have children, but some are what biologists call have a R strategy for breeding. That is, you can either be like a panda and just have a few children and invest a lot in it, or you can be like a fly or something, have thousands and thousands and hope a few make it. Well, there's some humans that do more of the kind of fly thing, this R strategy, as biologists call it, have lots of kids, and indeed the only reason it looks like they ever stop is because biology catches up with them. So these breeders, hate to use this language, but if there are some of these people take on super longevity, there's no reason to think that they, some people couldn't have hundreds and hundreds of children. There would be no biological reason. If you have a body of a 25-year-old when you're 150, and you start having kids when you're 20, and you have one every year, that's busy, but it would be possible. That would be 130 kids, right? That even if a couple like that are few and far between, you can still see that it only takes a very small percentage of them to add to the total population mix. That would mean that you need a whole bunch of couples then to forego having kids at all. So that's one sort of problem. But here's also, I think, forgetting about the breeders for a moment. Forget about kids for a moment. How many people, here have a black belt in karate? There's probably nobody. Anybody have a? So we got. Oh, look at that. So we got two. But now imagine that we all live to be 200, 300 years old. How many people will have a black belt in karate? I thought about it. If I could dial it in or something. But well, if I live long enough, I would get around to doing it. So I think, if we were to get back here in 300 years and see how many people had a black belt, I'm sure the number in this room would go up. But I think the same thing will happen with kids. Right now, some people have no children. I mentioned the two couples out of 10 now don't have any children. But imagine they hang around for long enough. Sooner or later, they might want to try having a kid. I got the black belt now, so maybe I'll have a kid. You can always, to keep that the average, down to two, the people who aren't having kids now can't have negative kids to offset that, right? We've already hit the wall on the one side of having zero kids. We can't go lower than that. I guess unless we have like child serial killers or something, but you can't go lower than zero, but you can go up higher. And the longer we're around, the more likely I think it is that people will have children. Just you've got more time to do these things. You might not. Some people may never have kids, no matter how long they live. But I think some people might think, I'm 150. I'll have a kid now. Maybe it's my first one. I'll test the waters and so on. From the general premise that living longer will allow you to experience more things means that we will have more chance to experience what it is to have children. And so I think that in itself should be sufficient reason to think that the birth rate will go up even in these technologically advanced societies. Also, too, in there is the thought of what you might call parental investment. Want to have kids, all right. How long are they going to be around? Well, legally, I can get rid of them at 16, but God knows, I have friends who've got 40-year-old kids hanging around in their basement smoking pot. It could be a big chunk of your life invested in. The kids would be around, presumably, for a long time. But the heaviest investment would be, you know, until they're adults themselves, and so say to 18. That's a big chunk of time. If you live to be, like we do now, 80, that's 25% of your time right off the top. I'm not saying wasted. I'm just talking about it's much better with the little bastards. So that's 25% of your life, okay. But suppose you live to be 200. It's not going to take, you know, there's no reason to think that it's going to take that much longer for children to grow up when we have these technologies. Indeed, it's possible it could go the opposite way. You might be able to speed the maturation process. But if you're talking about living to 200 and having a kid for the first 20 years, that's one-tenth of your life with this extra parental investment. So, I mean, imagine now, I don't know, maybe some of you don't have children, but imagine, you know, you could think, well, the kids will be grown and out of the house in the next 5 years, you know, starting from zero to five. Doesn't seem nearly the commitment, not nearly as scary, is it? If they're, well, that would be the same kind of proportion. And so that in itself, too, is why I think some people would be more likely to have children, just because the parental investment, it's not the same kind of commitment in terms of a total life that would make some people more interested. And finally, I mean, I just saw recently some scientific evidence that fertility rates actually are, the prospects of getting pregnant actually fall off for women in their late 20s. They thought it was in their mid to late 30s was the original kind of thinking. And so it may be that there's actually more demand for children than we actually realize right now. I mean, the technology for getting, for, you know, IVF or something like that, you know, technology to help you have a child when you can is still pretty primitive, and it's very expensive. My sister's gone through that and spent literally hundreds of thousands of dollars trying to get pregnant and never succeeded. So, you know, when we think about what technology will do in the future for someone like her, that seems too to be part of this idea that there may be extra interest in having children. So I submit that if you think that super longevity is a good idea, then you ought to take seriously the idea of overpopulation. So what should we do about it? Well, you could be like my students and say that we should prohibit it. We should not allow radical life extension people to use the technology. I, of course, asked them what the penalty should be. Is it the death sentence, I guess, is either, no matter what happens, if you don't allow it, I guess it is a death sentence. But that's indeed what they wanted to do. They wanted to have a global ban on any sort of technology that would allow people to live extra. You could live healthier years, but you're not going to be allowed to exceed what we've been able to achieve to now. So nobody's going to be allowed to live past 122 years. To my mind, that is a too radical of a solution. I suggest instead, if we are agreed that overpopulation is a serious issue, then we should all get one sort of ticket on the earth. And if you go for the super longevity technology, then you would have to, you know, get yourself fixed a vasectomy, tubal ligation or something like that. So you'd have to sort of sign a non-proliferation pack. right? That would be, well, I'll come to this in a moment. Otherwise, if you're not going to go for the super longevity technology, and indeed the students in my class at least said they wouldn't, then you would be able to trade in your ticket for having a single child, right? If a couple could have two. We're assuming the population is very bad. And I think that would be the most sort of equitable solution. Let me point out too, though, I mean, the non-proliferation pact, I take would be more of not a absolute ban on ever having children if you're a super longevitist, but it would have to be something like a moratorium. Because the number of people that the Earth can support, or indeed our solar system or the universe, is radically dependent on the kind of level of technology we have. Here's the thought experiment. Take away all technology having to do with agriculture. Well, while you have any other kind of a technology, it's no agricultural technology. How many people could the Earth support? I mean, the ensuing barbarism would be awful. I mean, we'd have to live as hunters and gatherers. We would shrink from 6 billion to, I don't know, maybe the Earth could support 50 million hunter-gatherers or something along those lines. So it'd be this massive die-off. So I'm just pointing out how radically dependent we are on technology, and that agricultural technology is such a recent invention. It's only, what, 10,000, 12,000 years old, and so on. So, and if we project to the future, indeed, as some have imagined, you could use asteroids and so on to make large space stations or spheres around the whole sun and so on. We could have trillions of people living in these sorts of structures and so on. So, so if you sign on for the Non-Proliferation Pact, maybe in 50 or 100 year increments and so on, we can review it as our technology increases. Indeed, you may be able to have more children if we start to build structures or go into space like this. Indeed, you could be one of these arb breeders. Maybe that will be encouragement, incentive for having all these children, all this place to fill up. As we said before, if we're thinking about maximizing happiness, you might have some duty to have some children. But at least in the short term, it seems to me quite likely that we could do something quite radical with life extension in the next 20 to 50 years. And so if we do, I think we would have to think seriously about population issues and so on. And so if we do that, then I myself would trade in at least the moratorium on having children for a world where we could all live in a reasonably happy manner, not being like the Star Trek world where we're all jammed in to one another. And that concludes what I have to say.